Back in 2012, on our previous incarnation, we released a two-parter reviewing HBO's lauded crime drama, The Wire. Created by former Baltimore journalist David Simon, The Wire is known almost unequivocally as the greatest show in television history. Sidebar Forever shares that opinion, full stop. And since the pandemic has us all spending far more time at home, we thought, maybe it's time to re-up. Inspired by another Wire podcast, as well as a terrific book that chronicles the behind the scenes of the show, we rewatched all 5 seasons. That's right, we're checking in on the detail with McNulty, Lester, Kima, Cedric, Herc, Carver, Prez, and Ronnie. And not to mention Avon, Stringer, Weebe, D'Angelo, Bodie, Omar, and even the silver-tongued senator himself, Clay Davis.
Shit.
It's been almost 20 years since The Wire debuted on HBO, and in that time, many of its character arcs and ruminations on inner-city life and the systems therein continue to resonate powerfully. So join us as we cruise the streets of West Baltimore, looking for stash houses and unsuspecting corner boys, because the game is the game. You feel me? As always, thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe to Sidebar Forever online wherever you get your podcast.
All right, we are back. Back in 2012, Adrian and I sat down and we recorded an episode exclaiming the greatness and the brilliance of HBO's The Wire.
Mm-hmm.
And we are back once again because we just couldn't stay away.
Yeah, we had to get that re-up.
In short version, we are huge fans of the show, and we were inspired by a book about The Wire called All the Pieces Matter by a guy named Jonathan Abrams.
Yes.
And also a podcast on the Ringer Network called The Wire, Way Down in the Hole, which we highly recommend.
Mm-hmm.
Hosted by Jemele Hill and Van Lathan. And it just made us want to come back and check back in on the detail and on the women and men on The Wire. And this is, for anyone who doesn't know, this is Adrian's fourth rewatch of the show.
Mm-hmm.
And it is my second rewatch of the show. So our perspectives are probably going to be a little different and a little more specific in this particular conversation. So,
yeah,
strap in. But Adrian, just drop a brief description for anyone who has never seen The Wire. I don't know why you'd be listening to this podcast if you hadn't seen the show.
but we're glad that you are.
Yeah, we are. We are. But,
definitely.
Briefly describe, man, what the show is about and its creators. And kind of what some of the 5 seasons cover over the course of the show.
Yeah, sure. Basically, The Wire was created by David Simon. He is a former Baltimore news journalist. And the show itself is about the city of Baltimore circa 2002 to about 2006, thereabouts. And you can encapsulate it as a crime drama, but there's so much more there. I would almost just say it's a drama.
Mm.
Just a drama about the American system at so many strata of class, race, power, economics, politics, education. To me, it almost seems like 5 shows in one, you know, which each of the 5 seasons almost represents. You have season 1, which introduces the viewer to the detail, major crimes, which is going after the Barksdale organization within the city of Baltimore. And from that aspect, yes, it is basically essentially a crime drama. You know, now there are other personalities and things that are involved in it, of course, but it's a straight on, pretty much a crime drama. Season 2 deals with what is termed as the death of work here in America, the death of industry. And we get a sense of the ports and the stevedores and just basically
how Baltimore used to be this major hub for shipping and commerce, and now that has been taken away, and we see from another level, you know, what that effect has on, you know, other lower to middle class people within the city. And then you have season three, which deals with the legislation, the politics of the city. So we're introduced to, you know, Mayor Royce and, you know, Councilman Carchetti, and just the behind the scenes, you know, goings on of, you know, what makes this city tick from that level, you know. And then season four is about education, the educational system, and the children that are caught within it, you know. And I say caught, unfortunately, in that respect, is because the system is trying to educate them, but at the same time, it's really just there as almost like a clearinghouse almost to keep them off the street for a few hours. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And you just find that, you know, the kids within the system, you know, they're being failed, unfortunately. And it's a battle to keep them, you know, to try and educate them. But, you know, they're losing ground, unfortunately. So you have that aspect. And then the final season, season five, deals with mostly the media. The news media. Mm-hmm. You have the paper there in Baltimore, the Baltimore Sun, which is Simon's former paper as well, the one he worked at. And we get that aspect of how they are covering everything and kind of the goings on behind the scenes with that as well. So, you know, when you're watching The Wire, you're getting, to me, five shows in one, you know, and you have to watch the whole thing. It's not one of those things where, like, many shows, I can just watch season three and be straight. No, I'll be honest. No, you can't. No, it's I liken it to the great American novel. Well, a great American novel in terms of you have to read it. You have to start it from start to finish to get the whole thing. If you watch or just absorb just one little part of it, you're missing the wider tapestry to your detriment. You know, so The Wire must be, it absolutely must be seen in its entirety for you to appreciate the fullness, the richness of the characters, the scenarios, and just how it really is a comment, you know, on the America, the American system. You know, it really is.
Yeah, I would agree with all of that, man. Absolutely. The Wire is often described as a novel, and it's because, you know, when you're reading a novel, you know, you're introduced to characters more slowly, there's less drama, there's less hyperbole involved, and characters that are seemingly secondary or tertiary in the beginning can become major characters as the novel progresses.
Yeah.
And we see that a lot with The Wire. And they had actually had novelists working in the writer's room. I think that was one of the things to the show's credit, is that they didn't actually have a lot of people who came from television working in the writer's room. There were, you know, crime novelists and people who were interested, who were had long histories in writing long form storytelling. So I agree with you 1,000%, man. One really does have to watch the entirety of the show to kind of get the fullness therein. Let's start with some general takeaways, man. Again, this is your fourth time around. This is my second time around. One of my big takeaways this time more than before was the fact, and we talked about this, you and I have talked about this before, but that there was no judgment given to a lot of the characters
right
on the show. Cops, robbers, teachers, politicians, what have you, dwellers of Baltimore, Charm City, they just, you know, you did good, you did bad, you know, you got caught in tight situations, you won, you lost. But there was, really wasn't a lot of judgment where there could be, you know, there really could have been.
Mm-hmm.
You look at a character like Avon, and as dastardly as he was, Avon Barksdale was a dastardly motherfucker.
Yes.
But, you know, he was likable, and he had a soft spot in his heart for his family and for the people that were close to him.
Yeah.
We'll talk about the character later on, Cuddy. He did Cuddy a real solid, man.
Oh, yeah.
You know, two solids. You know, one, Cuddy wanted to get out of the game, and he let him out of the game. And then two, you know, he loaned him money to start his gym which, you know, Avon was a former boxer himself, and he knew that Cuddy was going to be helping some of the young boys in Baltimore, you know, to learn the sweet science. And and so you saw a soft side to him, even though, you know, he was, you know, he was a gangster, you know.
Right.
Self-proclaimed gangster. Mayor Carchetti, you know, starts out as a councilman, becomes the mayor. And you see, you know, his character, you know, start to kind of get twisted up by the system as he becomes the mayor. But he is generally someone who really does seem to care about, you know, the city.
Yeah.
But there's no judgment given. You know, it's just people in situations and like you, you know, like you pointed out earlier, working within systems and how those systems tend to kind of grind you up and push you in directions that you never thought you would go in.
To Carchetti, I'm a hack. Royce was no different. Maybe I am. But every day they send over a new priority. Go after the bad guys. No, change that. Make quality of life cases. Get on top of the murders. On second thought, run the whores out of Patterson Park. You think the mayor tells the schools how to teach kids, or the health department how to do its job, or sanitation how to pick up trash, but get elected, and suddenly they know police work. You might think it'll be different when you sit here, but it won't. You will eat their shit. Daniels, too, when he gets here.
But what are some of your takeaways, man?
You know, that's a good segue into, like, one of the biggest takeaways that I had this go around, my fourth time, you know, and it didn't jump out at me, believe it or not, until now, until I saw it cumulatively as a whole, is that, you know, everything runs on a system. You have gangsters and dealers, they have a system operating. You obviously have, you know, the legislative branch, you know, of the city. They have a system of operating, the police department, the educational system, the paper. Everyone has kind of a system of checks and balances that, you know, you have to go through to get what you think you want.
Right.
But it really seems like that there are a lot more checks than balance to the show. You know, you see people. And the thing that strikes me about The Wire as well is how much, perhaps even more so than a lot of other shows I've seen, is that it really has like the veracity, the true veracity and verisimilitude of life, man. Like real life is there in terms of just there being so much gray, you know, because you see like people in the course of the show being rewarded for not doing the right thing.
Yeah.
You know, just simply, you know, being there and kissing ass, so to speak, much like real life. But you also see, yeah, ask me how I know. Anyway, but you also see, you know, people trying to work within the system and finding that they're banging their head against the wall. So they find a way to subvert that system and accomplish what their goal is, you know, and a lot of times there is collateral damage to be had. You know, there are people that are hurt along the way, bridges that are burnt, just a number of things happen for this one particular character, you know, to try to go after this goal and find a way to, you know, work through this system. But ultimately, you see in all levels, you know, in every season, you know, where a particular system is represented, you see the system take a character or characters, chew them up, and kind of spit them out, you know. And it's like some people, though, they learn how to work within the system in some type of strange harmony, and they actually succeed, but it's at the cost of, like, I hate to be as dramatic as the cost of their soul or whatnot, but you could tell that they're just trying to get by. You know, they found a way to make the system work for them, and they'll be damned if someone else is going to come in and take their spot. You know what I'm saying? And again, just so much like real life, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, there is a lot of collateral damage on The Wire. And that's made, you know, absolutely brought front and center, you know, with the kids in the school system in season four.
Mm.
Yeah. A couple other takeaways I noticed, too, and I wanted to get your thoughts on this, man. in watching this a second time, I noticed that Brianna is to D'Angelo what Frank is to Ziggy.
Elaborate on that.
So, you know, D'Angelo, you know, ends up catching a case. He gets caught with that weight in his trunk. And his mother talks him into going ahead and carrying the weight for the family. You know, that's what she keeps telling, carry for the family.
Right.
But she's his mom, and she kind of puts him in harm's way. She's not really thinking like a mom. She's thinking about everybody other than Dee in that instance, really. You know, and the other thing is Brianna kind of is leaning on Avon, D'Angelo's uncle, to kind of look out for him. But she's his parent.
Right, right.
And it's the same thing with Frank and Ziggy, where Ziggy is going the wrong way. Frank is concerned about it, but he's not really stepping in and making sure that his kid is doing the right thing. And then when he has that confrontation with Nikki, and he says, hey, you're supposed to look out for him. You're his cousin. And then Nikki says, yeah, but you're his father.
His father. Yeah.
So, you know, everybody's looking for someone else to look out for their, or not everybody, but Brianna and Frank are both looking out for someone else to manage their kid instead of them doing it.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah.
You know, and I thought that was an interesting parallel. But another takeaway I had was The Wire makes good use of secondary and tertiary characters in the sense of them coming in and out of the storyline and being important in terms of what they add. You know, there was a there was this kind of a drug chick in Hamsterdam. And then she shows up again later on in season five at one of Bubbles. She shows up at one of his recovery meetings later on. And she makes a really, you know, impassioned and personal, you know, speech and testimony in front of the group.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, wow, okay, I do remember that character. You know what I'm saying? But they don't point it out. It's just they just use this actor again for that purpose. But another one would be Dennis Cuddy Wise, his teacher girlfriend, who he's, you know, he's kind of not over once he gets released from prison. And he goes to visit her, and he finds out she works at the school, and he hasn't gotten over her. Isn't she the same one who's working in the school with the kids?
Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and she ends up being like an administrator and having more of a bigger role, like when the girl gets
slashed.
He's cutting the face with the razor, and she, you know, and so she has a bigger role. You think, oh, they're just using her as a device to kind of tell Cuddy's story, but she actually has kind of her own role to play in the overall story.
Oh, yes.
You know, and there are other characters too, like, you know, Santangelo, you know, Dozerman, and what's the name of the officer that that goes off on the civilian and then Carver ends up having to reprimand him?
Ah, Calicchio.
Yeah. It's just they make really good use of secondary and tertiary characters in the same way that a novel would.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, and it's funny because I recall very clearly when I was describing it to you after I watched the first episode, and and I called you excitedly all those years ago. I was like, man, I just watched The Wire, the first episode. It's like I was almost breathless. Like, oh, it's fantastic, man. And the thing that struck me, and I recall telling you was, man, you know. After like that first hour, I knew exactly who everyone was, like all the characters, you know, like normally when you watch a TV show or whatnot, the creators make such an effort to focus in on just this handful of characters, the star, the couple of co-leads,
right?
Maybe the villain, if there is one, and that's it. Anyone else, supporting actors, you don't know them. But in The Wire, for whatever reason, they stick out. And I don't mean like they're, you know, chewing the scenery or scene stealing or anything like that. You just know them. And I think because of the long form of the show, you gain a familiarity with them. So it's almost like seeing your boy or whatever, like somebody you kind of know, like an acquaintance, you know, like, oh yeah, I know him. I seen him around, that type of thing. But get to know them within the course of the show, and they're almost like as important as, you know, whoever the lead actor is in a particular scene, you know. And that really struck me, too, how, you know, the characters come in and out of the story, you know. And sometimes the what you might perceive as a minor character, perhaps even in some cases, one of the most minor of characters, and that is a pun, as we'll explain later, the most minor of characters will have a big impact on the story. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Huge.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I know exactly with whom you are referring, sir. Let's talk a little bit about, man, some of the language and the slang on The Wire, because that was something, you know, that I always just found was really humorous and fun. And some of it would make me laugh because I didn't quite get it. And then some of it, you know, you eventually got it as you watch more seasons. What's some of your favorite slang and language in The Wire, or maybe even sayings?
Yeah, a couple of my favorites were whenever they would talk about somebody, hey, man, why are you carrying me like that? You know, kind of like why we would say down here, why are you playing me like that? You know, how you going to do me like that?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, I just like the way that sounded, and you could evoke it in the way you could almost visualize it. Like, why are you putting this on me like this, man? Why are you doing me like this?
Yo, you all up on me before I do my work?
I'm not your yo. Baltimore has its own dialect. I know a lot of the actors go out and do their research.
The slang is completely different here.
How I would say, look at him, they say, look at yo. First time I read it in the script, I'm like, oh, this is probably a typo. In New York, New Jersey, we would say, oh, you playing me. Down here, they say, carry. Oh, you gonna carry me like that? That's how you gonna carry it?
In Baltimore, when somebody's talking about a dog, some people say Doug.
Look at that Doug over there, and that's dog. Doug.
They call, like, young drug dealers, they call them hoppers.
If I see any of y'all little hoppers even smile at a motor vehicle again, it's gonna be my people settling up with y'all in the alleys, you understand?
Can't do that, yo.
Try me, Naaman.
You know, and then another one I liked was whenever they would call somebody, and it's that long vowel, that Doug. Hey, what's up, Doug? You know? Because I think you and I discussed it, you know, Baltimore natives seem to have that kind of long vowel or a different pronunciation of those O's and U's. They're kind of long, like you or Doug, O, that type of thing. You know, I think you had even mentioned to me that, you know, Drew Hill, 90s R&B group, you know, natives of Baltimore, you could hear that in their in their singing, and I didn't notice it until you mentioned it, and I was like, damn, you really can.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, man. But yeah, those are a couple of the ones that stick out to me, man. What about you?
Definitely those two that you mentioned. And another one I thought about was like they would say on the show, you know, I'm telling you, He's after me. He's gonna do me. You know, as in someone's gonna out to get you, and someone's gonna, you know, gonna do you in. He's gonna do me. You know, Herc even said in season 4, I believe it is, he was like, you know, at first I thought he was gonna do me, then somebody did him. You know.
Oh man, you know the funniest thing. I don't know why this sticks out to me, but the funniest instance, not the funniest, but the thing that the instance that sticks out to me of that is when McNulty goes to Ronnie's house, I think in season 1 or 2, and he's telling Ronnie, and he's just such a sad sack at this moment. He's just depleted. Like, they're gonna do me, Ronnie. What, like Bell Biv DeVoe?
Yeah, yo.
And the first time I watched it, I wasn't sure until he elaborated on it. I was like, do me? What?
yeah, but that's the way that they say it, you know that particular terminology. But as far as local slang, that was I thought that was really interesting. This is something that we haven't really discussed, and I really wanted to discuss it with you. I think that the names for the characters in The Wire are really well chosen. They all feel like real authentic people to me, people that I would know from neighborhoods that I grew up in, people that would be friends of, you know, my parents or my peers or coworkers, people from my past. They all feel really, really authentic. And I don't think, like I said, we've ever really discussed it in in full, but like, you know, Omar Little, you know, Avon Barksdale, you know, Russell Stringer Bell, James McNulty, Felicia Pearson, which is actually her real name.
So real name,
yeah. That was kind of easy. Preston Broaddus, Bodie.
Yeah. Chris Partlow, that just sounds like just some dude.
Yeah,
Chris
Partlow. Chris Partlow. Reginald Cousins, Bubbles.
Yeah.
Michael Lee, Cedric Daniels, Kima Greggs, Rhonda Perlman.
And you know, and even at the official level, like Bill Rawls, Erin Burrell, like those sound like when you would go to like the the DMV and see like a portrait of like the commissioner, it sounds like a commissioner's name.
Yeah.
Commissioner Erin Burrell of the DMV.
Yeah, you know, William Moreland.
Right.
Bunk Moreland.
Mm-hmm.
Thomas Carchetti, Joe Stewart.
Yeah.
You know, Naaman Bryce.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's in contrast to how you see like many characters' name in entertainment, where it just comes off the tongue too smooth, or it just looks cool. It's like nobody's really gonna be named that. No,
right? Like if you go back to like the '70s, you know, it was like the Charlie's Angels names was like, you know, Raven Kilgood.
Right. What? Exactly.
So, but you know, Beatrice Russell.
Yeah.
Malik Carr, Poot.
Mm-hmm.
Ellis Carver, Howard Colvin.
Yeah.
And Leander Sidner.
Yeah.
You know, all real names, all very real sounding. They sound Marla Daniels. That sounded like Cedric's wife's name.
And you know, it's funny how all those names fit the character too. It's almost like it matches their demeanor and that character, even down to like the face. Like Jimmy McNulty, Dominic West looks like a Jimmy McNulty to this day. I've seen him in other things. He's always going to be McNulty to me. Like if I see him on TV or something else, oh man, McNulty in 300. Oh wow, okay.
Right. McNulty and John Carter.
Yeah. But yeah, it just fits. And I think that helps the familiarity of the characters too, because they don't have cool sounding names or anything like that. You know, it just sounds like actual people. So you almost start to refer to them as real people when you're talking or discussing the show, more so than other shows. You know, I feel, you know.
Yeah. Cameron Crowe has a story that he told. He did a movie, that movie, Jerry Maguire.
Yeah, yeah.
And he said that one of the, you know, just as a writer and as a person who's interested in how people talk and names and characters, etc., you know, he would go through old yearbooks and find interesting names.
Yeah.
And write them down and then, you know, use them later on. Jerry Maguire was a name that he got from a yearbook.
Oh, wow. Okay.
You know, it's just the name they saw in the yearbook and it just sounded like a person, you know, and the name, I guess, you know, to some extent stayed with him. Or maybe the name, you know, birthed, you know, the idea for the, you know, for the story that he told in the film.
Yeah.
But, you know, but that's an interesting exercise. And you know, and some of the names in The Wire, you know, Barksdale and there really was a Cuddy and some of the other characters. Some of those names, you know, were real people and they would just kind of move the pieces around, so to speak, you know, to try to make the characters for the show.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought they did a really good job with that, man.
Absolutely, yeah.
What are some of the criticisms that you have of The Wire? You know, we got tons of compliments for it, you know, and there's no shortage there, but what are some of your crits, man?
I guess one of my criticisms would be, and I know everyone likes to, you know, crap on that fifth season. That's almost like low-hanging fruit, you know, just in terms of, you know, that fake serial killer subplot or whatnot. I think beyond that, though, you know, one of the criticisms I have of The Wire is just the fact that it kind of stayed within the realm of, you know, the dealers, you know, and I know that is a driving force of the show, you know, in terms of, you know, the police trying to, you know, protract this war on drugs and so forth. But I really felt like, you know, what was kind of missing was had they kind of, you know, focused in on just a little bit on, you know, some of the more common folk, you know, more of the civilians. And they mixed them in, you know, to, you know, the series. But definitely, you know, kind of like, what is the true impact of having, you know, these corner boys and, you know, drugs, you know, infesting the neighborhood and so forth, you know. And like I said, they have instances of that, you know, with the little boy being caught by a stray bullet in season, I think it's 3, and other things like that. But I would have liked to have seen more of, you know, just the true impact on the civilians, you know, in the show, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, even with that, even with, you know, what they did show of that, you know, it still was enough to give you a good breath of, you know, kind of what that effect was. Just needed a little bit more to me.
I would agree with that, man. I think for me, and mine was more of a plot thing, and you and I have talked about this, but I thought that Omar believing Stringer, when Stringer told him that it was Brother Mazone that killed Brandon, and then Omar goes off, you know, after Brother Mazone, I thought that was a little too easy.
Yes, yeah.
Mm-hmm. It was almost like, you know, Stringer was using Omar as his own handgun and just pointing him in the direction he wanted the bullet to go. And Omar, who it seems to be someone who is, you know, calculating, he's thoughtful, he's contemplative, he sits back, he studies. He doesn't, you know, he looks before he leaps all the time. And that was just an example where he, as a character, didn't do any of that.
That wasn't me. That wasn't Avon either. Bird and them were there to see it, but another man did all the extras. All that cigarette shit. All that bullshit with the eyes. See, now this man, he building a rep for himself. And he wants you bad. The brutal shit, that's, you know, that's his calling card. Little bow tie wearing motherfucker from out of NYC. Yeah, small dude.
What'd he go by?
Brother Mazone. I know you heard of him, right? So if y'all got the mind to go after him, I might be able to point you in that direction.
Why?
What happened to your boy? It was business. But how that shit happened, I mean, you got the right to take that to heart. I figured that'd make us even. Now you wanna know where this nigga is?
Do you feel like in some instances, and I can see in other parts of the series where it was to kind of move the chess piece from here to here, in some instances, just to move the plot. Like, same thing, you know, with Omar as well. When they kill Butchie, when the Stansfield's crew kill mm-hmm. Butchie, and they leave one of them alive, one of Butchie's, you know, friends alive, to tell Omar, you know, let Omar know that we did it, you know. And so somehow word gets to Omar in this tropical paradise, you know, that, hey, this happened. Like some kid out of nowhere just rides up on this motor scooter and says, hey, yo, da 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 da, whatever, you know.
Right.
And he said, what'd he say? He said, hey, man, Butchie's gone. Really? So that really was to drag Omar back, you know, into the plot and get him back in Baltimore. Because for all intents and purposes, that was... his arc was done. You know, he could have stayed in, you know, wherever he was for, that's it. You know, but he came back out of honor for his friend, but also felt like that was just a chess move. We need this piece back on the board, you know?
Yeah. I think he was in Mexico, if I'm not mistaken. And just to put it in perspective, I mean, I don't have the actual exchange rate in front of me. But if he made $400,000 off of that, ripping off the Joe and everybody for the drugs and then selling it back to him, he could have lived off of that for the rest of his life. That was like $4 million.
Exactly. That could buy a lot of Honey Nut Cheerios.
Yeah. So, like you said, his arc was really over. And then for him to come back, you know, like, and to not ask, why did they do this? I mean, but he's an emotional person and he's extremely loyal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, those were the two things that they keyed in on when they did that to Butchie and dragged him back in.
Yeah.
Another, and this one is more humorous, but I thought the showdown between Omar and the brother was like a superhero comic book plot from the 70s.
Yeah.
You know, it's like these two badasses who they meet up and there's a misunderstanding and they fight at first and then they realize they have a common enemy and then they team up to go after the common enemy.
like some demented Marvel team up.
Yeah, yo. It was just like, okay, all right, you know. Even down to, you know, that kind of a spaghetti western standoff in the alley.
Yeah.
I knew you was coming back, bruh. Bow tie.
Bow tie.
Pull it slowly, then toss it.
Oh, I will move slow. I ain't tossing nothing. Bow tie. So whatever you're gonna do, you might as well go ahead and make it quick. I knew you'd come back.
I trust you didn't lose sleep over it.
Worrying about you be like wondering if the sun gonna come up. Ain't about to wild out over it.
That was one of the big and one of the great confrontations in The Wire. What are some of the other ones that stuck out to you this fourth time around? Big or small, doesn't have to be, you know, something as monumental as the death of Stringer Bell, but what are some of yours, man?
Yeah, well, definitely the confrontations with McNulty and Rawls, you know, just within the police department, you know, because obviously Rawls is McNulty's superior. And every time, you know, McNulty wanted to circumvent the system, once again, Rawls was like that gatekeeper of no, and I don't care. In fact, he didn't even care if it got a result, even the result that they were looking for. It's the fact that this guy, McNulty, wanted to go around official channels to get it done.
Right.
You know? And it's just like he could not abide by that, you know. But you also see, you know, in terms of the kind of leavening your sympathy almost, when Kima is shot, you know, as she's undercover, and Rawls is there to give that hard, tough love to, you couldn't even call it love, this hard speech to McNulty is like, look, it's not your fault. She was doing her job. This is what it is. And you're like, and you can kind of feel yourself kind of, your shoulders going down a little bit like, well, maybe Rawls ain't too bad. Well.
Right.
And then the next episode, he goes right back to being an asshole.
Well, and you know, it's funny because the first time around watching this, I thought Rawls, I remembered it more warmly and more fuzzily than it actually was.
Right.
He really was just telling him, look, you motherfucker, you're trying to make this about you. It's not about you.
Mm-hmm.
It's about her and the decision that she made to be a police and to be a part of this detail and to take this job and go undercover. This is about her. It's not about you. If it was about you, I would tell you it was about you because I fucking hate you.
Hate you. Right.
You know. So and now I realize the second time around, it's like he really wasn't being that nice. He was just giving him like taking him by the shoulders, basically, and like shaking him and saying, hey, look, you need to sober up about what's going on here. You know?
Yeah. Do the job. Yeah. Get out there and do your job.
Listen to me, you fuck. You did a lot of shit here. You played a lot of fucking cards and you made a lot of fucking people do a lot of fucking things they didn't want to do. This is true. We both know this is true. Dr. Ralston, please call cardiology. Dr. Ralston. You, McNulty, are a gaping asshole. We both know this. Fuck if everybody in CID doesn't know it. But fuck if I'm going to stand here and say you did a single fucking thing to get a police shot. You did not do this. You fucking hear me? This is not on you. No, it isn't, asshole. Believe it or not, everything isn't about you. And the motherfucker saying this? He hates your guts, McNulty. So you know if it was on you, I'd be the son of a bitch to say so.
What are some others, man?
I would say, you know, the confrontation, if you can call it that, between, you know, Stringer Bell and Clay Davis, just this sense of, literally, Clay Davis is like banging your head against the wall. He is for better or worse, mostly for worse, he is an institution there in the political system. You know, if you have to deal with something coming from the Western or whatever district that is, unfortunately, you have to go through slimy ass Clay Davis. And Stranger thought that he could. He thought he could, you know, kind of wash the problem with the money hose and just spray it down. I just keep throwing money at it, and I'm sure it'll come. But he kept seeing in little increments. It's like, no, it's not. He's taking you. And you have other people telling him, no, he's getting over on you. And, you know, Stringer's like, no. This can't be happening like that. And even Clay himself, in so many words, is like, yeah, just keep giving me money. Just keep giving me money and, you know, we'll get it done. And just finally, you know, I think Stringer realized that I can't go around this dude. So I got to take this dude out. That's the gangster way that he knows how to handle this.
Yeah.
You know. So that confrontation was like, it's like the street butting up against legislation. And it's just like, it's always going to be loggerheads. Nope.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it, man. That is it. And Clay Davis is, he never met a bribe he didn't like, yo.
Oh, man. You know, and I had an interesting note about that. Yeah. In fact, in season 4, in episode 2 to be exact, Clay Davis, you know, is ranting to Mayor Royce about, you know, how he's been served with a subpoena about the campaign contributions.
Mm-hmm.
Major Crimes and Lester Freeman, you know, is starting to investigate where this money is going to and where it's coming from and everything. And, you know, Clay tells, you know, Royce, he's like, you know, do I have time to ask somebody where they get their money from? I mean, if a motherfucker is giving it away, I'm going to take it.
Where do y'all think I'm going to raise cash for the whole damn ticket? From laundromats and shit? From some tiny-ass Korean groceries? You think I have time to ask a man why he giving me money or where he gets his money from? I'll take any motherfucker's money if he giving it away.
Yeah, well, I don't want to know.
I know you
do. You know?
Yeah, yo.
What's interesting, though, earlier in that same episode, Marlo and his crew are in the neighborhood passing out, you know, money to the kids for back to school. But ostensibly, Marlo was just trying to spread his name. You know, he's like trying to make sure his name rings out, you know, across the hood. But Michael, one of the kids, does not take his money. And Marlo is like, man, why you don't want this? He's like, nah, you know, just I don't want no handouts or whatever. And so when they're walking away, Michael's two friends, Naaman and Randy, they kind of chide him for it.
Right.
You know, and Michael's like, oh, okay, if y'all want to take it, that's fine with y'all. And Naaman says almost verbatim the same thing that Clay Davis says. He says, look, man, if a motherfucker is giving it away, I'm going to take it. I was like, wow, that's interesting to see how at a legislative level and at the street level, it's the same thought process, you know. If someone's go give the money to me, whatever, I'm gonna take it, you know, no difference.
Yeah, and that's, you know, it's funny you should say that, because I was watching one of the episodes, the new episodes of The Boys season 2.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And there's a scene in there where Starlight, who's living in this mansion, you know, in the tower, she's got like this really luxurious, you know, apartment. And A-Train comes in and he says, you know, if you bring down Vought, you know, it's going to be people's, you know, houses, cars, their lives, you know, they're going to lose their lives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and she says, well, you know, there's more important things than money. And A-Train says, you know who says that? People who came from money.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I imagine, yeah, you know, Clay Davis, all of them, you know, they had humble beginnings and, you know, here we are. A couple other confrontations I thought about was Jimmy and Brianna, when he told Brianna, you know, hey, I told Donette because, you know, I wanted to tell someone who actually cared about D'Angelo. You know, aren't you the one to talk D'Angelo into carrying that weight? You know, and then ultimately, you know, D'Angelo ends up, you know, dying or in their case, committing suicide.
But mostly at this point, I'm sorry I bothered his girl.
And I'm sorry she bothered you.
Why go to her? Why not come to me first?
Honestly? I was looking for somebody who cared about the kid. I mean, like I said, you were the one who made him take the years, right?
Another confrontation was Bubbles in room one, you know, when he tried to hang himself after he unwittingly caused the death of Sherrod.
Yeah.
Kima and Cheryl, you know, talking about the baby and you know, their relationship breaking down. That was a good confrontation.
Mm-hmm.
And another one, and it's not really seen as a confrontation, but when Stringer and Avon are on that balcony.
Oh, it is. It absolutely is. And it's so funny how it's bearded over them talking about, you know, their childhood and everything. It's almost as if the writing was to say, look how long they've been together. Look how long they've been friends, you know, pretty much brothers. And you know it's coming to an end. You know it is.
Yeah, most definitely. Most definitely. Who do you think won out of all five seasons? Which characters came out of the show ahead or having lost very little when it comes to The Wire? Because, you know, we could easily point at the losses. Some of those are, you know, more dramatic and more explicit than others. But who won, do you think, in your opinion?
Oh, man. Dang, I almost have to lean back in the chair for that one.
Well, I'll throw a few out there and see what you think. I think Rhonda Perlman won.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I think in an ultimate sense, Marlo won.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he didn't do any time. He got to keep his property. He got to keep his money. He sold the Kinect.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I think Dennis Cuddy Wise, I think he won.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, I think for the most part, at least up until the point that the show ends, Tommy Carchetti won.
Yeah.
You know, he wanted to be mayor. He wanted to, you know, take a higher political seat in Baltimore, and he got that.
You know, I would also say that Naaman Bryce won, you know, just getting to. We see him coming up from, you know, the corner and everything, and eventually finding, you know, a place and a home where, you know, his adoptive parents, you know, Bunny Colvin.
Yeah. Yeah.
They actually care for him and they've steered him to the right way, you know, and, you know, he seems to be thriving, you know, within that, you know, versus where he came from and, you know, what the inevitable end probably would have been for him, you know.
Yeah. Last, I think Bubbles won, man.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
He won big time. You know, he overcame his grief as far as the death of Sherrod and eventually his sister who was hard. She was hard like a black family member who's been fucked over by a drug family member.
Yeah.
She was hard like that.
Mm-hmm.
But she still loved him, and then eventually he was able to come and sit at the table with her and her daughter.
Oh, that was such a great moment, man, you know, where for the entirety of him living with her, he was just kept at the bottom of the stairs, you know, like the Count of Monte Cristo or something. You know, but I'm telling you, when she opened the door, he actually, you know, ascended the stairs and was able to sit at the table.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the first time I watched that, I teared up a bit because they really played that well. And it was like, wow, he's actually, and I don't want to say civilized, that's the wrong word for it.
Right.
But just finally, he's initiated back into the fold of family. Of someone who truly cares about him, even if it's tentative, at least that's a step in the right direction for Bubbles, you know. So it was just great. And the other one I want to throw in too is Cedric Daniels. To me, he won. Like, he was a company man.
Did he really win though? You think he won?
Even though he kind of, his hand was forced. It's like, look, I gotta go. He eventually got to the place where, you know, he got his law degree, or he was practicing law. You know, he played the politics within that system. And then he was just like, you know what? Maybe I'm not cut out for this. I mean, just, you know.
See, I think he lost. I think because he got two promotions.
He did, yeah.
And he had to give all that up.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, he did it. He kept his integrity somewhat intact.
Yeah.
But I just thought, you know, he didn't come out ahead. He came out different, but he didn't come out ahead or where he was. He actually had to make hopefully a lateral move and, you know, and go into law, you know, practicing law. So I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah. And it just seemed like his life might have been a bit more stable or whatever, because, you know, obviously he had a relationship with Pearlman, you know, and, you know, it's cool to see like her up on a judge's bench and then him coming in as an attorney and them giving like that knowing glance of like, okay, I'll see you at home. Okay, cool.
Right. I'll see you at the crib.
Exactly.
Yeah. Before we rank all five seasons and we can end it there.
Mm-hmm.
I did want to talk about kind of a passing of the mantle. Some good, some bad.
And there are several. Yeah.
Yeah. Duquan is the new Bubbles.
Yeah. Yeah.
Michael is the new Omar.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this is one I didn't think about until after we talked last time, but Carver is the new Bunny.
Yeah, I can see that. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I'm gonna see? When he made the tough call,
mm-hmm,
and reprimanded his officer, and then Herc was asking him, was it worth it? And he said, yeah, you know, it was worth it. It's what needed to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And you see him taking that kind of stance, you know, because those were the two stances that Bunny took. You know, when it came to Amsterdam, let's do what needs to be done so that we can do good police work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, same thing with the kids. Okay, let's separate them. Let's do what needs to be done so the ones who can learn, and the ones who can't, let's focus on them in the way that's more effective, you know.
Yeah.
It remains to be seen, but, you know, Ronnie is the new Judge Phelan.
Now, who do you think became the new McNulty? In a sense, I almost think it was Sidner.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
We see him in the suit. You know, he's talking to the judge and whatnot. And he's kind of, he has that cocky assuredness that, you know, McNulty had in episode one, just talking to the judge. And it was like, okay, all right.
And he even has a nice, you know, coda, you know, he tells the judge, hey, and please keep my name out of it, like McNulty did in season one.
There you go. Yep. Mm-hmm.
So he's kind of like the new McNulty in a way. Would you say if she ascends in rank, Kima is the new Daniels?
Yeah, because the integrity is there. The want to be good police is there. Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah, yeah. I think so. All right, let's go ahead and rank this bad boy, man.
Okay, oh, man.
We'll start from number five to the number one position.
Okay.
All right, you go first.
All right, man. Shoot, number five. Man, it's got to be season five. You know, just even though I loved, absolutely adore, you know, the arc within the newsroom or whatnot.
Yeah.
That false serial killer thread and everything just really brings that season down. I couldn't stand it. Oh, I hated it.
Yeah.
So number five is going to be season five for me. Number four is actually going to be season two. And, you know, not because it's battering thing, you know, and I actually liked the change of the cast of characters from season one, you know, with the Sabatkas and the dock workers,
mm-hmm,
and the plot of the Russian girls in that can, in the container, you know, and the introduction of the Greek and so forth. It was just another element to, you know, the criminal activity within the city, you know what I'm saying? But yeah, number four would be season two for me.
Mm.
Number three would be season one. You know, obviously season one kicks everything off, and it's just a solid crime drama for the most part, you know, with touches of great character interactions, you know, just everything that you would want from a great hour of television, you know, and, you know, definitely, you know, makes you want to watch, you know, the further stories of these particular characters. So yeah, season one at number three for me. Now, we had discussed this and I had to change. I thought about what we talked about. So I kind of credit you for this. But number two for me would actually be season four. You know, and season four, man, heartbreaking. It takes you on these peaks and valleys in terms of character, motivation, feeling for these children. You know, the criminal activities. Like, it is such a ride. To me, that might be one of the best seasons of television ever. And that's saying a lot. That's being very hyperbolic, but it's fantastic. But, you know, just based on kind of what we discussed and some points you made, yeah, number two for me would be season four. And then number one would be season three. You know, just because, you know, there's so much there. I mean, you get several different things coalescing at once in this season. You have, you know, the mayoral, you know, race starting to heat up. So you see the legislative part. There's still the criminal activity going on. You see the introduction of, you know, just them finally trying to nail down the Barksdales and then this new guy coming through, you know, the Stansfields. You know, but you also see what I think is just the just great. Such a great device and such a great piece of storytelling. The whole arc about Hamsterdam and how Bunny Colvin is trying to use this to keep crime off the streets in certain parts of the city and get it contained, you know, and it's so people think he's a renegade for it, but you see the results. But yet, you also see the detriment in terms of the cost and, you know, the human casualties, you know, inside of Hamsterdam.
Right.
Yeah, it's like bringing hell and say, okay, within these five blocks, hell is going to be right here. And when you go into it, I almost liken it to when Bubbles is selling stuff from his grocery cart, you know, through Hamsterdam. He's kind of walking through Hamsterdam with his grocery cart. It's almost like Apocalypse Now, where the riverboat is kind of going upriver. Mm. The further it goes upriver, it delves deeper into like this primordial just hell and mire and just people just acting, just their baser instincts just taking over and just, oh, you're like, what is the cost of having no crime in these other sections if all you have here is just the worst of people's intentions and people getting caught in this crossfire? It's just terrible. And it's just so highly emotional. Just, oh man. So, it made me feel just, oh. So for that reason and the others we discussed, number one for me would be season three.
Okay.
Hand it over to you, good sir.
Hey, man, we fully agree, dawg. I'm looking at my notes and I got 5-2-1-4-3.
Damn, yo, I hit no whammies.
Yeah, yo. That's exactly it. And for the number one spot for season, well, the number five spot for season five being exactly what you said, I really, really was thoroughly invested in the machinations within the newspaper, the Baltimore Sun. But the serial killer thing just fucked me up, you know.
Oh.
It was just awful. But season three, you know, yeah, it's the conclusion of the Barksdale crime organization and that investigation.
Mm-hmm.
It is, you know, we see the friendship and really the quote marriage of Stringer Bell and Avon Barksdale break up.
Yeah, yeah.
We see Omar finally get his vengeance for Brandon.
Mm-hmm.
We get introduced to Carchetti. We see the rise of Marlo Stansfield.
Mm-hmm.
And they just get a lot of heavy lifting done in season three that I really, really appreciated. And And I just liked it. I just really enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
Enjoyed it a great deal. So, man, for anyone who has not seen The Wire, at the risk of repelling you because people talk about it so much,
yeah,
it really is a fantastic show. And I was listening to another podcast, and they were saying that, you know, the first couple of 2-3 episodes, you may be like, okay, I kind of like this, but it's like by the third episode, something clicks in you, and you're like, oh, this is my shit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, the show definitely becomes, you know, comes highly recommended, and here we are, you know, almost 20 years later, still talking about its resonance and its impact on television and on us as fans.
The Cadillacs stood by the house, and the Yanks they were within. And the Tinker Boys they hissed advice, but were with a pen. Well, we turned and shook as we had a look in a room where the dead man lay. So Big Jim Dwyer made his last trip to the shores where his father's lay. But 15 minutes later we had our first taste of whiskey. There was uncles giving lectures on ancient Irish history. The men all started telling jokes and the women they got frisky. By 5 o'clock in the evening every bastard there was pesky. Pretty well gone away, there's nothing left to say. Farewell to New York City boys, the Boston NPA. He took them out with a woolen cloud and I often heard him say, I'm a freeborn man of the USA. He fought the champ in Pittsburgh and he slushed him to the ground. He took on Tiny Tartan Allen and only went one round. He never had no time for reds, for drink or dice or horse.
That concludes this episode of Sidebar Forever, hosted by Dwight Clark, Swain Hunt, and Adrian Johnson. You can find us online at sidebarforever.com. Any emails or questions can be directed to us at sidebarforever@gmail.com. And also, subscribe to us on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and Instagram. Sidebar Forever is copyright 2020. Dwight Clark, Swain Hunt, and Adrian Johnson.